tugboat down by the river, cement bags. I was reminded of Mac the Knife as I was reading the story of the last pirate of New York. There is a real story, by the way, of Mac the Knife. The song that we hear Bobby Darin sing is his version of the Louis Armstrong version of the Three Penny Opera, which had been popular in the New York, up on the state, New York stage sometime in the early 50s after a revival. And yet even that, the Three Penny Opera is based on a real story of a killer, sort of a guy who had become, at one point had been the talk of a very similar community as in The Last Pirate of New York, back when New York of the 19th century was still largely a city of fishermen and of wharfs and of big giant ships and people bringing in seafood. And it was a very different kind of commerce back then, before leading up to and then even for a period of time after the Civil War. And there were still pirates. And we'll get into that coming up in just a minute when we talk with Rich Cohn. I got to thank Dan Filato for hooking me up with Rich Cohn. I also have to thank Tim Williams for making the arrangements for David Zucker last hour. If you are someplace safe where you can sit and enjoy a show tonight, you're going to love this story from a guy who knows all about the gangs of New York, both now and then. Rich Cohn next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Told that nobody can tell, but I'm broadcasting from a building that's right in the midst of a violent thunderstorm that keeps shaking the floor. It's pretty loud over here. Glad it's not showing up on the air, but it's been like this all evening. It was a perfect way to read The Last Pirate of New York, A Ghost Ship, A Killer, and the Birth of Gangster Nation, of a Gangster Nation. Rich Cohn joins us on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Rich.
Hi.
All right, so been reading the book for the last couple of weeks. I don't want to give away the ending, but there's so much to get to before we even get to the story. And I think part of that has to start with your story, because you're the author of a book that I had read a long time ago, the book Tough Jews. And I thought that was a really interesting book. I've always been interested in the different types of gangs, but also bestsellers, Tough Jews, Monsters, Sweet and Low, When I Stop Talking, You'll Know I'm Dead, with Jerry Weintraub, and of course, your work for the Chicago Cubs, Story of a Curse, co-creator of the HBO series Vinyl, contributing editor at Vanity Fair and Rolling Stone, and I could go on. But you had a long-standing interest in the mobsters and the stories of gangs of New York long before you wrote this book, which is a very unique story, which I can't wait to get into.
Yeah, well, you know, I grew up in Chicago, but my mother and father from Brooklyn. And I used to sort of believe that, like, people asked me what my father did. I said, I thought being from Brooklyn was his full-time job, you know? And he just would tell stories about gangsters from his neighborhood instead of regular bedtime stories. And I became fascinated by those stories. And when I first moved to New York to try to be a writer, I just started tracing down the true stories behind the legends he told me to try to figure out if they were true. And that ultimately turned into my first book, which was Tough Jews, which is also a way to tell sort of a gangster story that I thought was a story that hadn't been told but had been told, if you know what I mean.
Oh, dude, totally. I read it. I was like, I'm one of the people that picked it up off a table at Barnes & Noble or something. Because I grew up on the North Shore of Chicago, and there was a Jewish mobster that had gotten, I think he was killed in Highland Park at one point when I was in high school. And it was just up the street from where my godmother lived. And that was my first introduction to that idea of the different ethnic groups still maintaining some level of organized crime activity around the country.
Well, that's interesting because I grew up in Glencoe. I was born in Lake Forest. And I remember when there was that guy killed and he ended up in the trunk of the Purple Hyatt, I think it was, in Lincolnshire. That's the one I remember from being a kid. But You know, it was interesting because there was a big, I always try to figure out what was it that made me want to write Tough Jews and like what's the nature of my pathology. And part of it was just gangster movies. You know, my father used to say, I'd be like, I'm going out. He's like, sit down, watch The Godfather, learn a little about life, you know, and all this Chris Cuomo Fredo stuff. My father always said I was the Fredo of the family. It was his way of giving me a hard time. So, and when I'd go back and try to read about these real stories, the there was always the Jewish characters from the big ethnic, you know, migration, just like every other ethnic group in America, Irish, Italian, German, they all had underworld kind of thing happen in the neighborhoods that they first lived in. But by the time I, The Godfather, it was a Mike Meyer Lansky character that was sort of the accountant to the mob, and it was sort of the Jewish stereotype within the underworld. And so the guys I was writing about were Murder, Inc. And then later they kind of showed up in Boardwalk Empire, but they were kind of forgotten about. And they were, you know, the tough guys on the street that made half of this Jewish and Italian gang in East New York, Brooklyn, and in Brownsville, Brooklyn, which was Murder, Inc. And that thing, when I moved to New York and I was just exploring the city, that was so interesting to me as a crime story, but also as a New York story. And the idea of like the city's almost mythology and its past, and not just the mythology of sort of the official history, but the underworld history. And that led me back, you know, that's so long ago. That's like, I wrote that book came out in 1999. And so, and I was 29 years old. So, and this book is just, this new book is a natural outgrowth of that because this is the deep history of the New York underworld.
Are you a New Cher kid?
I am class of 86.
Yeah, class of 78.
Yeah, so you would have maybe gone to school with my sister.
It's entirely possible. In fact,
Yeah, she was a class of 78 or 77.
I hung out with all of those, I would say mostly Jewish kids from Glencoe in my group, Frank Jaffe and Lee Lasky and a bunch of other people that, and we used to make mobster movies using our like a Super 8 camera that Frank had in Glencoe. We were so fascinated with mobsters. And then later, not too earlier before that though, I had gone to a school called North Shore Country Day, and there was a girl there whose father was assumed to be in the Greek mafia in Chicago. And when I knew her, I mean, at the time, I think we were in fifth or sixth grade, there was a bomb was planted on their front door and blew off the front of their house in Winnetka, which was like, it was like that didn't happen, you know, that kind of thing just
No.
didn't usually happen. But it was very interesting, you know, the how the and the, that was the rumor that okay, well, that's Greek mafia, and then we knew about the Jewish mafia, and then so that was at a time when everybody was still talking about the Italian mafia, but we were seeing some of these other groups, and that was one of the reasons why I picked up Tough Jews when I saw it and bought it many years
Right, and
later.
Chicago has its own, you know, the thing I always, there's a famous Chicago gangster called Nails Morton, and they always say that he made the west side of Chicago safe for the Jews, and that was the Bugsy Moran's gang, the Bugsy Moran gang that then was defeated by, if I got this straight, Al Capone, who'd come in from Park Slope, Brooklyn.
Sure.
And
Moved into Cicero.
yeah, and Bugsy Moran, I don't know if you know Nails, how Nails Morton died, but it's one of the craziest
No, I don't.
underworld. What?
I don't. Tell me the story.
Okay, so he became very successful. He was trying to, you know, become less in the mob, and he was trying to become sort of society, and he rented a horse or whatever, I don't know if rented's the right word, in Lincoln Park to go for a ride. He got bucked off the horse, kicked in the head, and died in Lincoln Park, kicked by a horse. And the guys in the Bugs Moran gang went the next day and got the horse out and brought the horse back to the spot and whacked the horse.
That's just so they could have a great story.
Maybe.
Yeah, which I think actually brings it is sort of the perfect way to come back to your book, because your pursuit of the last pirate of New York really starts with that idea of the way that mobsters tell stories about the previous generation of mobsters. And I think we know that even just from, you know, television, just from Sopranos, just from other things where we can see that there is an awareness that gangsters have about their legend and how they're going to be talked about. Maybe because there's a sense of their impending death all the time, that no one's going to live to a ripe old age. So you might as well leave a casket that you can have open and a good story that people are going to tell about you. So I thought that was the pursuit that I thought was a really interesting way to go about this, that you were just trying to find out who was telling the first story of the very first gangster of New York. And that's what started you on this.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always really interested in how things begin, what the origin is, and that's maybe a common thing, with all my books. I mean, one of the books I wrote, which you didn't mention, was The Record Man, about Chess Records. Leonard Chess lived in Glencoe and was the first guy to record all that rock and roll
Sure.
music. And it's sort of like, where did that come from? And with Tough Jews, it was sort of, where did the whole gangster culture come from? And, Arnold Rothstein being the first guy supposedly that carried a money roll in his front pocket. When you asked him for money, he would just snap off like 20s, And then you have that still, if you go through valet parking, the guy's still doing that. And it's like, I just like love the idea of people imitating people, imitating people they didn't even know they were imitating,
Right.
And that's, I guess, the idea of culture, basically. And when researching Tough Jews, I came across this story. And it really, I think I heard it from these other gangsters, these guys who are alive, who'd heard it, who'd heard it, who'd heard it. But also there's a great, great book, which is sort of misunderstood a little bit, which is The Gangs in New York, which Martin Scorsese sort of based his movie on, although that's
Right.
more of a composite.
Right.
And that book is so interesting to me because it's sort of like the underworld is like a whole culture, and it has no mythology, it has no history really, and he's creating it. And he goes back and talks about almost the prehistoric gangsters who were in New York in colonial times. And the first sort of one of these guys that leaves a actual record in the newspapers and becomes famous like a modern gangster, it's so long ago they don't call him a gangster, they call him a pirate. And that was this guy, Albert W. Hicks, who was the last person publicly executed in New York, convicted of piracy, but was clearly a model for all the modern gangsters, right up to Al Capone and John Gotti, from the way he handled himself and the way he dressed. And I just became fascinated by him as sort of the guy that was like such a badass that he didn't even have to belong to a gang, because you belong to a
Right.
gang for protection, and he was a guy you needed protecting from,
Right. But I think
So,
that's
and
where.
for years I tried to write this book two or three times before I sort of finally figured out how to do it in the last few years.
Well, it's a fun. You're a very good writer, by the way. I really enjoyed
Thank you.
that. And you're. He's such a. And this is where the word is in its exact meaning. He's a pivotal figure in history because. As you point out, it's pivoting. I used it, it's kind of a weak metaphor of talking about it, where piracy sort of took root on land and became what we would consider to be these kind of modern gangs. And the
Yeah.
pirate became the gangster. But that's really what and in a lot of ways, that's exactly even what happened in the story. And we'll get into it more in just a moment about how he did this transition. But it's such a fascinating idea that there was no word gangster, there was no word mobster. Pirate made sense, but there still were pirates. And that I thought this was, I didn't even realize this, that even in mid 19th century New York, and I'm sure other cities as well, that piracy was still a real problem, and it was kind of almost sounded like in your book, almost like a youth thing. Like a lot of young gangs were still out on boats, and they were committing acts of piracy on the water outside of the shipping lanes or in the shipping lanes.
Well, they did a federal government study in 1859, which is when this story takes place, 1860. There were 450 known pirates living in Manhattan. So, and basically, piracy was, they defined it as any crime that occurred on the water. And New York was a city because it has this great natural port, and it was the biggest port in America and a huge amount of commerce. And if you were a criminal, that's what you fed on. And it was the boats and the harbors, and it was, a lot of them were these youth gangs that didn't rob people in the slums. They robbed people on the water, and they had those very colorful names like the Daybreak Boys that would attack boats on the river in daybreak. They had the Swamp Angels who would go up the Hudson River, then called the North River, and attack farms in Westchester. And then you had actual pirates who were out all over the world. Albert Hicks was on whaling ships all over the world. and they would attack big ships out in the ocean, and then they would come and sort of lay up in New York, lay up in New Orleans, lay up in Liverpool, England. And but when you really look at them, the way they operated wasn't like, you know, the yo-ho-ho in a bottle of rum like Treasure Island. It was more like John Gotti hitting cigarette trucks, you know, and basically selling this stuff. And you realize that the – see, you said it's right. It's pivotal to me. It's like Albert Hicks is like the, you know, the missing link that climbs out of the primordial ooze up on the land and becomes the first modern gangster.
And starts to breathe – air. Yeah, exactly. And that's where, and that's why he is the last pirate of New York or the first gangster of New York. It's right at that. He's both. And it starts with the killing on a ghost ship. And so we'll tell the story coming up in just a minute. But I think actually there were times, and I know it's easy to make a comparison more to the Sammy the Bull Gravanos and the Gottis of the world, but in a lot of ways he kind of reminded me of Kuklinski, of the Iceman, of that the classic really psychopathic or at least narcissistic sociopathic killer that had no regard for anybody else and was perfectly happy to kill for a buck because as far as he was concerned, he was the center of the universe and everything revolved around whatever he could get.
Well, you know, actually one of the big formative things in my life, I think, is when I was a kid, I was sick and they put a TV in my room and I wasn't supposed to watch it at night, but I woke up in the middle of the night and I'm like, I want to know what's on TV in the middle of the, like right now, this time. And I turned it on. This movie was on called Angels with Dirty Faces. You ever seen that movie?
Oh, plenty of times. Yep.
Yeah, and it just, I mean, I was like 8 or 9 years old. And that movie, I think, had such a formative effect. James Cagney, and it's this idea of institutions sort of destroying people at a real social vision. But I think that that's one of the things that was interesting about Albert Hicks, which was he was committed a petty crime. I don't know how much you want me to get into it now, but he committed a petty crime. He was one of 11 kids, grew up on a farm in Norwich, Connecticut, the youngest. Ran away from home, ran out of money, was in Providence, Rhode Island, stole a piece of luggage, traded the stuff he found in the luggage for enough money to get home, and was caught and put in an adult prison and was brutalized and escaped and was caught and beaten and escaped again. And finally, they put him in solitary confinement for a year. And he later said that he went crazy in that year and decided that if he ever got out of prison, he was going to take his revenge on the world. And that's exactly what he did. And you're right, he did it like a psychopath, completely coldly, ultimately. And people say to me, well, was he like a serial killer? Because he confessed to over 100 murders. I'm not an expert on what makes somebody a serial killer. To me, he wasn't, because his crimes were all about getting money and robbing. And he killed people who could tell on him, basically. And I researched the phrase dead men tell no tales. He did not invent that phrase, but he's the one who made it kind of famous because he said it in a public trial in every newspaper in the country, and he said it again and again to explain why he killed people.
Yeah. So just to go back a second or two, I used to watch those the Dead End Kids movies, which started the Angels of Dirty Faces. WGN used to, TV in Chicago used to run them endlessly.
Maybe that's where I saw it. I mean, Fraser Thomas and Family Classics.
Right.
Yeah.
Fraser Thomas he lived right next to a friend of mine, and it was like he hosted this popular kid show too in Chicago for people that don't know him, and like the greatest fear in the world was that your ball would go over the fence into Fraser Thomas's backyard because he hated kids. He hated it. If you climbed over the fence and tried to get your ball back, he'd start yelling at you. The Last Pirate of New York, a ghost ship, a killer, and the birth of a gangster nation. All right, so what about the ghost ship? This is what really starts the legend of Albert Hicks, and we'll have Rich Cohen tell the story next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. It's a very different time in New York, in the development of New York. It was still much like more how we might think of, Seattle, or I can't even think of anything comparable. Galveston, maybe, I don't know, where tons of commercial fishing was going on all the time. It was the main industry. And that brought also a lot of trade as people were going up and down from New York to other port cities. And that meant carrying a lot of cash as they were doing a lot of trading up and down the eastern seaboard. And that, of course, attracted pirates, which attracted the last pirate of New York, who Rich Cohen has identified as really the proto-gangster, and we'll talk more about that very specific, very scary story of the ghost ship of this killer next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So you gotta love it after you think you've seen every mobster movie, you think you've heard all the stories, and then you come across The Last Pirate of New York. It tells the story from a completely different perspective. The development of the gangster nation that we all think we know, but there's a moment, and there's a guy, and his name is Albert Hicks. So let's tell the story of how he ended up on this boat, and how it is that he went on this spree, which ends, of course, eventually in his hanging.
Well, so he was, this is like the classic mob movie thing where a guy decides to just do one more crime to set himself up for retirement, and that's the one that he gets caught on. And he was this guy who, ever since he'd gotten out of prison when he was about 20 years old, had this become a pirate. He would, but not a pirate like as a member of a crew. He worked alone or with one other guy. He would sign under the crew of a ship, usually whaling ships. And he would work on the whaling ship until things started to get bad, and then he would stir the rest of the crew to mutiny, and he would kill the officers, often abandon the rest of the crew or take them with him, take all the money he could, and run. And he made and lost huge fortunes. He was all over the world. He was at the Gold Rush in California. He was in California when it was Mexico. He, at one point, to launder his money in Mexico, opened a bowling alley in a hotel, and he would get this money, lose this money, and he was getting older. His former partner had died in a shipwreck, and he was 40 years old, which in pirate years is like 110, And he was newly married, had a young child, and he decided he wanted to commit one more crime to set himself up, and he was alone. So he was looking for a ship that he could handle the crew himself. And he answered a want ad on an oyster sloop in New York, called the E.A. Johnson. And an oyster sloop, because oysters were a crop that would go bad if not delivered very quickly. So they had a deal all in cash. And his idea was he worked on the ship around New York for a couple of weeks under a fake name called William Johnson. And as soon as the ship got away from land out into the Narrows, which is where the Verrazano Narrows Bridge is between Staten Island and Brooklyn, he took the axe off the wall and he killed everybody in the crew of the ship. And that's basically the setup. And for me, the image that stuck to me was this ship just found abandoned in New York Harbor, ghosting. They called it a ghost ship. And that was just a terrifying sight in New York at that time, because the entire city below 14th Street was all about the water. In one way or another, you were connected to the sailors and the sea. And they sent out police to search this boat, and the boat was entirely empty, abandoned. And all they found, though, was a lot of, they said it looked like it, as if it had been, the entire ship had been washed in human blood. And they towed it into South Street Seaport next to Fulton Fish Market. And the detectives went on board and searched the whole ship. And finally, one of them noticed by the rail of the ship, four severed fingers and a thumb. And that was where the detectives, which were new and famously corruptible, started. It was also one of the great early acts of detective work in New York history.
So I want to highlight something, because I don't think most people would know this, that you mentioned the idea of the oyster sloop is they had to travel because the oyster beds around New York had become largely contaminated or overfished. And so how far did they have to go to get oysters in the first place?
Well, yeah, New York had been this great source of oysters, and it had been contaminated. It had been, and so they went down to West Virginia. They went down to Virginia to get oysters, and it was, I think it was like 3 weeks, 3 weeks back, and they'd buy James River's oysters and bring them up and sell them in the fish market and make a lot of money. And the guy who, the captain of the ship, who was one of the guys killed, he had made enough money to buy his own ship. And but they had to carry just a ton of cash. And he had an investor that gave him, I don't know, it was probably the equivalent of about, he could probably be carrying the equivalent of about $100,000 now. But one of the interesting things about it was the currency in New York then in the country wasn't really uniform yet. It was before the Civil War. And one of the ways this guy got caught is after he got away, he got on the Staten Island Ferry. I can go into more detail about it, but he'd abandoned the ship, rode a dinghy 3 miles to Staten Island, walked across Staten Island, gets on the Staten Island Ferry and has a cabin boy who's an immigrant from Ireland, a 22-year-old immigrant working, sweeping out the decks, help him count the money he's stolen because he can't make heads or tails of it because it's all different kinds of currency and coins. And the cabin boy can make better sense of it because he sees this money all the time.
But even in that idea, the oyster sloop, they had to load it up with ice to preserve these oysters. And so in a lot of ways, these ships were kind of vulnerable because they were so heavy and because they had a very specific run. There was, and so it didn't require a lot of crew, which is why when he signed on, there were just two other people. I guess they were brothers, and then the captain. That's all you needed to get the ice ships down, to get loaded up with the oysters and then get them back to New York before they went bad. But that was like a, it was like a race run. It was like you had to race down to get it and race back. And that's what made them so vulnerable, was all of that cash and the fact that there was just very few people on there. So once he overcame the crew, it was just going to become, it was just down to him and the captain.
Right. And he applied as the first mate, and he was actually a great sailor. And he came with his own set of tools, which was a big deal. And there's letters of the captain writing to his wife about how great this first mate he hired is. And he'd sized up the crew, and there were these two, they were half brothers, and they were young. One of them was like 17 and very skinny, and he'd just gone to sea for the first time. And he basically decapitated that guy with an axe.
Right.
And the other one, the older brother, was the one he was most nervous about because he was bigger. So he went after him first, and then he got in this fight with the captain, which they sort of pieced back together just by the axe marks in the roof of the cabin. And it's this incredibly grisly scene because, and I told this right at the beginning of the book, because the book isn't like a mystery. I wanted it to be a story about New York and the grisliness of the crime and the horror of the city discovering this crime is really what it's about. And he thinks he kills the first brother with an axe. And then the other brother sticks his head out to see what the noise is, and he goes back to him, and he basically decapitates him, and his head rolls into the shadows, and his headless body falls down a ladder back into the captain, where the back into the cabin where the captain is in bed. So the captain is woken by a headless body dropping basically out of the sky at his feet.
Right.
And then this guy comes down with this axe, and he keeps yelling, "Is that Barnegat Light?" which is a landmark that they'll see. And I don't, he just kept sick. And
it was a disorienting thing to say, which I thought was actually pretty clever, that he kept getting everybody to look out for Barnegat Light, which they weren't supposed to see for hours yet. And so they're looking out in the direction, and that's when he whips out the axe.
Exactly. And it's almost like it presents somebody like a math problem, like they start thinking of something else.
Right.
Like almost without, and he told us in his confession, this was what he did. And then he gets in this long fight with the captain, according to him, which could go almost go either way. And they're able to piece it together because there's axe marks in the mattress, there's axe marks in the ceiling, the whole cabin's destroyed. And then later on, he confessed and told the story of it. And he finally overcomes the captain. He goes back up to the deck of the ship, and he's, you know, can't breathe, and he's winded. And the first guy who he thought he'd killed is back on his feet coming at him.
Right.
Which for a second he thinks it's like a ghost or something. And then
right.
finally he throws the guy off the ship, and the guy reaches up and grabs the rail, and he chops off his fingers with the axe, and that's what they find. But
later
the
on.
Whole thing was, you know, people are like, because after he got away, he was so brazen in his the way he acted, you know. But the thing is, back then, if you didn't find a body, it wasn't murder. And in fact, they couldn't even charge him with murder because there were no bodies. There were just the fingers and the thumb. That's why they charged him with piracy. So he thought he'd completely gotten away with it like he'd done many, many times before. But he just ran into a lot of bad luck for him and a lot of good luck for the detective. The first being that before he could sail the ship and scuttle it far from the scene of the crime, he got collided with by another ship and had to quickly make a run for it in the dinghy instead of properly sinking the ship, which he meant to do. So he thinks he sunk the ship. He put holes in the side of it, and the city wakes up in the morning, and there's this ghost ship in New York Harbor, floating. And that just sets in this huge manhunt, which at the time was like the biggest manhunt in American history.
And so his usual MO of killing the crew, taking the money, scuttling the ship, getting away, it's blown, and through a series of, you know, freaky occurrences, like the guy who took an axe in the back of the head, originally the brawnier brother, doesn't die.
Right.
And I mean, it is just an amazing story. And yet he does eventually get away on the yawl, and he's able to get away from the ship with the money that he was able to get from the various parts around the ship. And what do we think? It was about $100,000 worth, roughly, that he was able to get?
Something like that. I mean, it's hard to exactly translate what it is now, but a very large amount of money for him, especially. And then he went with the money to a bank. And basically, then you'd go get banknotes from a bank, you know? And that's another way. There are all these ways they caught him. And in his hurry, he stole a lot of other stuff, not just money. He took everything off the sailors he could. And a big mistake he made is he took the captain's watch that his wife had given him that had an engraving in the back, and the jeweler who had done the engraving was able to identify it. And he'd also taken a daguerreotype, a little photo of one of the sailor's fiance, and it was like one of those that's in half, and she had the other half.
Right.
And back of the picture of him that she had was some of his hair. And they found hair on the ship in the blood, and they're able to match the hair. It's like early forensic evidence.
Really? Very early.
By passing it to the jury, and having him look at this hair and this hair, is this from the same head? And then they had her come up and say, it's definitely the same hair. I know because I cut his hair every month.
But that's – so, you know, it kind of brings us back to Goodfellas, right? And where De Niro is telling the crew after the Lufthansa heist, lay low. Nobody buy anything. And when they start showing up with pink Cadillacs and furs, he goes nuts because this is what will get him caught.
Right.
And I just thought that was so interesting that it was the same thing back then. That if he had laid low, if he hadn't gone on a spending spree, if he hadn't started flashing money around and coming up with these different explanations every time he was spending the money that he had stolen from the ship or had these different items, he might have gotten away with it. If he had done what the original plan was, which was just collect the money and go back to his wife and his daughter in New York, found a place to bury it, wait till it was over, he might have gotten away with it. We never would be telling this story.
Right, but it's like one of those things, character is destiny. He was a pirate, and he was like a drunken pirate.
Right.
And he thought he'd already gotten away with it because he thought he'd sunk the ship and he got rid of the bodies. He'd done it before. And the first thing he did was he missed the ferry. That was a big part of it, too. By like 2 minutes, he missed the ferry and he had to wait for an hour. And there was a little bar there. And he goes into the bar. And like you said, everybody asks him where he's coming from. And he's making up a different story every time. And he is just spending all this money. He's buying drinks for everybody. And he's making them sing songs of them. And he's just like a crazy, scary, drunken pirate. And everywhere he goes, people remember him. One of the details that really caught me is in the New York Times at the time, they talked about how he'd gone into this place and he'd eaten oysters and eggs and drank a bottle of whiskey.
Mm. We're talking about
right after the killings, he drank like 12 probably pretty weak beers that they had on the ship to kind of catch his breath. And he'd been up for days. He started with him committing a triple homicide.
We're talking about the last pirate of New York, who really is the first gangster. And this is the ghost ship in the subtitle of the book, because the ship that he robs doesn't sink, even though he tried to scuttle it as always. It floats in. When people go and tow it in and they start examining, they find all the human blood, then they find the fingers, and they know something has happened. They never, I mean, he did take the bodies including spending a certain amount of time searching around the deck to find the head of the second guy that he had killed. And he had to collect all those and he had to get those off of the ship. And that part, at least, he was pretty experienced at. At this point, how many people do we think he has killed?
Well, when he confessed later, they asked him how many, and he said he couldn't remember because at that point they'd counted over 100. So they never said an exact number. They just said he'd confessed to over 100 murders.
And these murders were mostly of sailors, mostly people with whom he would have affiliated in that part of in the lower part of New York. Why was there not already some sort of Jack the Ripper-like legend that was growing about this whoever it was that was killing all of these men?
Well, he was all over the world, so a bunch of his killings were in San Francisco, outside of San Francisco during the gold rush. They would rob the gold mining camps, and instead of taking the time to mine for the gold, they would just kind of mine the miners, if you think about it.
Right.
And those crimes were all blamed on another guy who I'm forgetting his name right now, but he was sort of the basis for the real life Zorro. And this is a time when New York was having its biggest crime spree in history, and the per capita murder rate was out of control. And there were murders almost every night in the Five Points, in the slums, and the police wouldn't even go in there. So they didn't, and there was a huge wave of Irish immigration right at that time. So, and the thing about the ships is, ships would just disappear. And this is a big part of the book is the idea of recovering New York at that time. And this is a time where people were shanghaied on the ships.
Right.
Where, ships would come in, sailors would jump ship because life on the ships was terrible. They were short crew, they had to leave immediately because maybe they'd have a thing like oysters or something that was going to go bad. And they would hire a shipping agent who would go get them crew. And the way they would do it, they'd go to these little hotels called crimps on Cherry Street on the East River. A lot of them were built on piers over the harbor. A guy was drinking, somebody would slip a Mickey in his drink, which was mostly opium, follow him into his bedroom, hit him with a blackjack, if not kill him, just knock him unconscious. And there was a trap door right in those rooms, and they drop him out the trap door into a rowboat. He wakes up on a ship and he's told work or swim. And in the worst case scenario for him, the ship is bound for China and he's gone for a year. Everyone thinks he's dead. And that's where the term Shanghai came from. And so that a lot of his crimes they just attributed to wrecks at sea or missing at sea, and nobody ever really knew what happened. And one of the reasons why his confession seems to be true is he confessed to a lot of crimes that had never been solved all over the world, and his confession was used to solve those crimes.
And I don't mean to hammer at that point, but it just seems like sailors are so uniquely superstitious, and the stories they share tend to come from the fact that, as you mentioned, the crew from one ship might get broken up when it goes in the harbor, and three of those people end up on another ship, and everybody's telling stories. And I guess I'm sort of surprised that somehow a Flying Dutchman-like legend wasn't building around some mysterious killer of sailors or of people in, in the under these you mentioned the.
I think to some extent it was, I mean, I think he was, you got a sense that he was already a very well-known, very feared figure, but no one knew exactly what he was doing or why. And he did it over such an extended period of time. And, I think that he was very careful about it. And you mentioned all the fish coming through New York and the fishermen, but it wasn't just that, it was all the cotton coming from the South going to England. And that's really what they lived on. They lived on the early Industrial Revolution and on robbing that money. And I think that there was a lot of crime going on, like there were 450 pirates in New York. But I think that there was a legend and people were aware that there were these pirates and but they were never quite sure who did what. So that was even what his lawyer depended on. His defense attorney said, well, there are these river pirates I told you about, and they were active in the harbor that same night. Maybe they did this,
Well, we'll pick that up. Hang on to that thought because I also want to ask you about the gangs of New York. It's tangential to your research, I mean, in one sense, but at the same time, it forms the backdrop to this, and the Irish gangs. I think we may even see some parallels here with some stories that are going on in the news right now. But we'll get back to that in just a second. Rich Cohen, the book is The Last Pirate of New York, A Ghost Ship, A Killer, and the Birth of Gangster Nation.